It's very nice to be back here in these beautiful, idyllic settings. Maybe I'll move down here. That's a threat, I think, to some of you. But I remember with such fondness my days at UVA and Richard Merrill telling me why I had the wrong idea for practically every idea I had in class. And of course, he was correct. But eventually, he sort of molded me into something at least semi-presentable. For the last 15 or 20 years, I've been studying as an avocation the relationship between law and the daily activities of people in our society, which is a subject that has not gotten that much attention in the academy. Law is a powerful driver of human behavior, supposed to be a driver of human behavior, but there's a tendency nowadays to think of law as more of a self-contained system, where we have theories of law, we like the theories, they're well-motivated, and we follow that. Inertial forces drive us and drive law in a certain direction without necessarily looking at what the effects are on the functioning of the society. But law is only supposed to be a tool. It's not something that exists in itself. It's not a religion. Its values are not permanent. It's only as good as how it operates and how it helps the free society around it to operate. And of course, we're all told that law is the foundation of a free society. But in recent decades, I've been arguing, this legal system has become more like a minefield. There's hardly any social interaction in society that's free of legal implications. Now, that's good if we're talking about people not feeling like they can cheat or steal or such, but legal accountability is very important. But it's perhaps not so constructive if people no longer feel free to do what most of us would think is the right thing to do, or to be spontaneous in dealings with other people. And it's in our business lives, in my business life, it's necessary that law is a part of business. And I'm not actually trying to get rid of all the lawyers. What life without lawyers is about is allowing people to live their lives without having to worry about law all day long. But law has pressed down not just in business communities or in government regulation, but in people's daily activities. A couple of years ago, I was hiking in Cody, Wyoming with a group, and our guide was a local science teacher. And she found out I was a lawyer, and the story started pouring out. She just finished an episode where the parent had threatened to sue the school because she lowered the grade of a paper by 10% because it was turned in late, which is the rule in her class. The principal wouldn't stand up for her and just tell the parent to do whatever he wanted, but we're not going to change the rules, because he didn't want to get dragged into a legal hearing, even if it was a baseless one. He didn't have time. Life's too short. This went on and on for back and forth for 30 days as she told the story, with repetitive meetings where people said the same thing over and over again, sleepless nights, and finally she just gave up and raised the grade back up. She said, life's too short. About the same time, she was taking two students to a student leadership meeting in Laramie, which is several hours away. She was going to drive them in her car, and then she was told she couldn't drive them in her car because of liability concerns. So the school provided a school bus that held 60 people that drove the three of them with a driver, rumbled 2.5 hours to Laramie, waited for them, and then drove them 2.5 hours back. About the same time, her husband, also a science teacher, was going to take his biology class out for a hike in the nearby National Forest, as they always do, and a field trip. But one of the children was disabled and couldn't go, and so the school told him that he could not take the class on the field trip because it might violate the rights of the one student who couldn't go. At the end of this day, the stories kept pouring out. I could have filled a book with stories from this one teacher about how law has distorted the decisions in her school. You can't talk to a doctor without getting stories. I have a pediatrician friend in Charlotte who said he doesn't deal with patients the same way anymore because, quote, you wouldn't want to say something off the cuff that might be used against you. I mean, think about going through the day as a pediatrician who's in this profession to take care of children thinking that all day long. And then, of course, my law firm, which is a great law firm, I think, has a list of questions that I'm not allowed to ask interviewees. Now, in my case, those of you who know me, perhaps I duty list the questions I'm not allowed to ask interviewees. But one of the questions I'm not allowed to ask, because it's obviously bulging with innuendo and hidden meaning, is this one: where are you from? So, you know, anything can be asked in a way or done in a way that's inappropriate, but just because it could be done in an inappropriate way doesn't mean you have to stifle all human conversation and spontaneity. But that's sort of what's happened in our society. And we all now know the drill about how law works in society. If there's a dispute or disagreement or accident, everybody peers into the legal microscope. They try to imagine, is there anything that could have been done differently that might have avoided this accident or this dispute? Could the warning have been greater? Could there have been more open communication with the worker who lost his job or didn't get the promotion? And of course, in hindsight, anything could have been done differently. You always could have, in hindsight bias is perfect. But there's not actually a world in which, if everybody complied with the law perfectly, everyone would agree on what's fair. It's just not the way the world is. We can't make accidents extinct. It's part of motion that if you move, sometimes things go wrong and you'll fall or unintended consequences happen. And yet that's sort of the operating assumption of how our legal system works. And yet we don't have a vocabulary of how to deal with it. I mean, we don't want to go back to the old days where people could do whatever they want and be racist or discriminatory. We obviously want lawsuits for when people act unreasonably. And so we don't even know how to deal with this decision, this phenomenon of now everything seems to be a potential lawsuit. And that's because, I submit, we have the wrong goal for law. We've been trained to think of law as a system of individual rights. Law is not mainly a system of individual rights. There are rights on the edges that our founders gave us, the rights of free speech, government can't barge into our homes, and such. But basically, law is a tool for society. It's a system of balanced judgments. And law has to look at the effect on society much more than the effect on the individual. And it doesn't do that anymore. No one is trained to do that. That's not what judges do. It's not what officials do. We look at each individual case and think that somehow that's independent of the workings of the rest of society and not looking at the social effects. And if you pull back and you look at how law is affecting society, you see a dramatic skewing of a free society away from reasonable choices, away from common sense, away from accomplishment, away from freedom. So in healthcare, for example, which is something that we've been working on, I've been working closely with Jeffrey O'Connell here, among others, on this. The culture of healthcare delivery is toxic. Now, Lucian Leap gave a talk as a great patient safety advocate at a forum we hosted in Washington a couple of months ago, and that's what he said. He said, the culture of healthcare delivery is now toxic. And the reason it's toxic, mainly, is because the defensiveness has swept over all interactions. One effect is that doctors waste huge amounts of money on unnecessary tests and procedures. It's very hard to measure because there are mixed motives. Sometimes they make money on the procedures too. But the responsible estimates of how much defensive medicine is range between $60 and $200 billion a year. That's more than enough to provide health care to all the people who don't have it in our society. It's wasted. And we all can tell stories of our own experiences going to the doctors where the doctors, we know they're ordering tests that they don't think are needed, just because they've now been trained to think they should lean over backwards in case there's the sick person gets sicker and there's a lawsuit. The trial lawyers say that the fear of litigation makes doctors practice better medicine. Well, that's been studied by the Institute of Medicine. It turns out the opposite is true. The distrust of the system of justice has so chilled professional interaction in hospitals that it leads to thousands of tragic deaths a year because people are reluctant to speak up. Are you sure that's the right dosage? Because they're not certain, and they don't want to take the legal responsibility in case they're wrong. And so it's actually affected patient safety in an adverse way, and that's the reason virtually every patient safety expert has joined our Coalition for Legal Reform. Not because they're tort reformers, because they're trying to create a system where doctors can focus again on actually doing what they think is right, not trying to protect themselves. Schools are literally drowning in law. You have a section of the legal library for each of the following legal concepts: special education, due process, no child left behind, zero tolerance, work rules, tenure, just on and on. It's literally, you need a legal library. We did a study of all the rules that affect one school in New York City a few years ago. We went to the Board of Ed. They didn't know. They had no place where they had all the laws that affected a school. No one had ever compiled them. There's so many. Well, it turned out there were tens of thousands of discrete legal requirements governing each school, so many that, of course, no one could ever know them, including 60 steps and legal considerations to suspend a student. One of the effects of all this law has been the rise of disorder in schools. Richard Aram, a sociologist at NYU, has studied the rise of disorder, and it turns out to be directly correlated with the rise of due process. And the way it works is that students now believe that the teacher can't make a choice unless the teacher can prove it in a hearing. And it doesn't really matter that the teacher will always win the hearing, which is generally the case. There are very few lawsuits against teachers. But the students now believe that the teachers don't have the authority. The teachers don't believe they have the authority. And the result is, according to a survey a couple of years ago by Public Agenda, 43% of high school teachers in America say they spend more time maintaining order than teaching. That means that those students get at most half the learning they're supposed to. And what happens when a teacher tries to maintain order and assert her authority over the classroom? We also did a survey of that with Public Agenda. 78% of the middle and high school teachers in America have been threatened with lawsuits by their students. I mean, think about what that says about the change in the culture. It's not that they usually sue, and it's not that they would win if they sued. But what it reflects is an extraordinary corrosion of authority that makes it impossible to maintain order. And if you can't maintain a culture of respect and order, kids can't learn, or they have a lot of difficulty learning. Government is paralyzed by the, not mainly by litigation, but by the accretion of law. I mean, our founders made it very hard to pass laws on the theory that that would preserve freedom. But now after 200 years, especially the last 50 years, the accretion of law is so thick, it's like sediment in the harbor, that no one can get anywhere, and we can't unpass the laws. Because it's much harder to unpass a law, even to pass a law, because all you need is the legislators in Florida and Louisiana to want the sugar subsidy to continue, and they'll get it. Because the way legislators work, it's give and take. Everybody has their own special interests, and they have to give them to each other. So a couple of weeks ago, it came out that part of the stimulus package, $5 billion passed 14 or 15 months ago to weatherproof 590,000 homes, sounds like a good idea, had not been spent. The reason it had not been spent, because of a law passed in 1931, signed by President Hoover, which requires that any contract, any construction job that's funded in part by federal funds has to have the wages set as a matter of law by the federal government in each locality. So for the last 14 months, hundreds of bureaucrats have been trying to set the wages in 3,000 different localities for weatherproofers. This makes central planning look efficient. There's absolutely no sense in this rule, but it's there. The unions like it. It's called the Davis-Bacon Act. And it's been on the books now for 80 years. And it's all piled up in this paralyzed government. In the State of the Union speech, Obama said, there's no reason in the world why China and France should have the fastest trains. Yes, there is. Environmental reviews have evolved into processes of no pebble left unturned. They go on for the better part of a decade, followed by years of litigation by any person who doesn't like the project. It'd literally be the year 2020 before a shovel gets in the ground on any high-speed rail project or power line or anything else. The President of the United States doesn't have the authority to do these projects because the law is taken away from him. But I think perhaps the funniest aspect of all this is that people are acting like idiots. I mean, all day long, people like my law firm's question. When my firm merged with Covington, and they gave us new coffee cups that said Covington and Burling, that said on the side, caution, contents are hot, down the spine, so you had to turn it over to read it, which is really not that clever, and actually not that clever just to have the warning anyway. I mean, as if people don't know that an apparent thing that's hot is hot, that you need to tell them that. You know, you need warnings for hidden risk, not apparent risk. Anyway, those cups no longer exist. Indeed, they were all destroyed quite soon after they were discovered. But the canary in the mine here are how we deal with children. The society has really completely, the gyroscope is completely broken in dealing with children. It is the rule in America that you cannot put an arm around a crying child. Nobody will do it. Who will defend you if somebody says it was an unwanted touching? It will ruin your career. It has ruined people's careers. So that is the rule. You see these strange photographs of crying children and a teacher sitting there looking at the child like that, as if giving this child a lecture or something. All the second grader needs is a hug. But you can't do it. You get in trouble if you do that. Broward County, Florida, a couple of years ago, banned running at recess. What does that mean? It means all the boys have ADD. You know, if you can't blow off steam at recess. Why? They had 186 claims from playground accidents. If kids run around, they have accidents. It's in the nature of being a kid, and they have accidents. It's actually not bad for kids to have accidents. It teaches them how to take responsibility for themselves. We've actually done forums. We've got all the play experts together talking about this. The other day, there was a story in New York where a 9-year-old girl was led away from the school in handcuffs because she marked on her desk with a magic marker. Imagine a child doing that. I mean, my children, you know, mark on mahogany furniture with ballpoint pens, and they're 23 years old. I mean, they're not, kids are not completely in control of what they're doing all the time. It doesn't matter if there's a rule against defacing public property. You know, these are 9-year-old kids. You don't lead them away in handcuffs. But that's the rule. I mean, it's idiotic. I mean, the stories can go on and on. But in all of these stories, nobody is doing what they think is right. Not the people, not the doctors, not the teachers, not the people dealing with the kids, not the president. Nobody's doing what they think is right. So why are they doing it? Because they're either scared of law because they don't trust it, or because there are so many rules they don't even know them, so they don't trust it for that reason. What's wrong with this picture? And trust is incredibly important in the legal system. One of the most fun things about doing the research for this book was doing research into the cognitive effects the way people accomplish things. It turns out people don't actually consciously make things happen. The smart part about humans is in the dark, deep recesses of the brain, where instinct and judgment and experience and all these things are kind of reside, and people act. So as one scholar put it, people disappear into the task. They're focusing on what they're doing. They're not thinking about focusing on what they're doing. As a wonderful book by a polymath called Michael Polanyi in the 1950s called Personal Knowledge, making this point, he said a pianist can't play a piece if she's thinking about hitting the notes. You can't accomplish things if you're self-conscious. What we've done with this legal system is driven everybody from the smart part of their brain, that dark, deep well of the subconscious, into the thin veneer of conscious logic, where people now go through the day, well, I doubt if that headache's a tumor, but if it is a tumor, how will I protect myself in case there's a lawsuit? Pretty soon, we've wasted $200 billion in unnecessary MRIs. That's how people are going through the day. Well, I know Johnny threw the pencil first, but how will I prove it? Well, I have to call other students to the hearing. Well, pretty soon, people are throwing pencils all over the place because the teacher doesn't feel they have authority to do that. Well, why don't we trust the system of justice? Well, it's not even trying to be trustworthy. Civil justice is now presented as an ad hoc process. The regulatory system makes central planning look efficient because it isn't calculated to make people, it can't be internalized by the people expected to abide by the rules. There are too many rules. Teachers can't internalize thousands of rules. Maybe an expert in the EPA can deal with the expert rules for environmental review. That's fine. But not for real people who are out dealing with people all day long in a society. Well, it turns out that freedom has a formal structure that we sort of ignored and forgotten. And the formal structure is this, and that's what it means to live in a free society. Law sets boundaries. And on one side of the boundaries are things you must do or can't do. You can't steal, you've got to pay your taxes. But those same boundaries are supposed to affirmatively define and protect a dry ground of freedom where you can do whatever you want. You can be obnoxious, you can not come to this lecture, you can do whatever you want to do. You can walk out right in the middle and you'll get an F, but you will walk out right in the middle. You can do whatever you want. You won't be unaccountable, you just won't be accountable by law. That's what living in a free society is supposed to do. As Isaiah Berlin said it, law sets frontiers not artificially drawn within which men shall be inviolable. That idea has been lost to our time. Those dikes have burst. People wade through law all day long. There is no interaction that doesn't have legal consequences. There was a scholar called Donald Black, who I think was at Virginia, who once said, an act is illegal if it is vulnerable to legal action. It's not the finding of illegality, it's the risk of illegality. And what's happened in society, our current conception of what, we made everything illegal because it's potentially illegal. And no one's drawing those boundaries as a matter of law. And it's incredibly important to draw these boundaries in lawsuits because lawsuits are not an act of freedom. Lawsuits are a use of state power. It's just like indicting somebody. You're just indicting them for money. You would never tolerate a prosecutor seeking the death penalty for a misdemeanor. So why do you tolerate some crazy administrative law judge in Washington suing his dry cleaners for $54 million? It's crazy. It's an abusive legal process. And yet we let those things go forward. So the other day somebody sent me a claim where someone sued Continental Airlines because he was asked to move his first class seat so a parent and minor could sit together, move to another first class seat. And he was offended because he was sitting next to a federal marshal. That's the whole complaint goes forward. The federal judge writes a considered opinion about the duties of airlines, the passengers and stuff, and it goes up on appeal, and there's a considered opinion about the duties of airlines and such, and the case is dismissed. The person should have been fined and ridiculed for bringing such a claim. That's not what law is about. Courts shouldn't be used for cases like that. You can't normalize the conduct by taking it seriously. And so what's happened in our society is instead of establishing boundaries, what people can sue for establishes the boundaries of everybody else's freedom. If somebody sues because their kid fell off a seesaw, it doesn't matter what happens in the lawsuit. All the seesaws will get ripped out because no one will want to take the risk that next time they'll get sued. And the jury might render a different verdict. And by the way, that's what's happened. There are no seesaws left in America. There's one set of seesaws left in the New York City park system. I know the parks commissioner is a friend of mine. He kept them, notwithstanding the vast liability implications of it, just for sentimental reasons. And I can tell you where they are in case you want to go up. Seesaws are very important because they teach you to distrust people. I learned to distrust my brothers at an early age. It's very important when you're a child growing up, only to go on a seesaw with someone you trust. So what we're calling for in this, with Common Good, and we can talk afterwards about some of the more concrete things we're planning, is a series of concrete reforms, but all going toward a basic shift in legal philosophy to restore this dry ground of freedom. So, for example, in health care, which is just incredibly important because, of, among others, its budgetary implications, we now have a broad coalition behind the idea of creating special health courts. They'd be administrative health courts. You would have administrative judges who would be charged with writing written opinions. They would have funding to hire neutral experts in each area, so they wouldn't have the experts for hire. There'd be expedited proceedings. We have an early offer program at the beginning, which was pioneered by Professor O'Connell, to encourage early settlement. There would be complete transparency and feedback of all the data from settlements and everything else back into the system. All of that's now lost in the current opaque litigation system, so that hospitals can learn from their mistakes. This is a proposal that was developed in a joint venture by my organization, Common Good, and the Harvard School of Public Health over the last 5 years. And it's not an exaggeration to say virtually every legitimate group in healthcare is in support of it. The largest consumer groups, AARP, all the patient safety experts, all the providers, everybody's in favor of it. President Obama, finally, about a month ago, wrote a letter to Congress saying he was now in favor of doing pilot projects of health courts, which is doesn't make it happen, but it's at least a hole in the dike. The Congress, God bless them, have provisions in the health care bill that make it illegal to do a pilot of health courts, as well as to do early offer programs or anything sensible, because one of the parties, I forget which one, is in the pocket of the trial lawyers. But it will happen. It will happen because we can't manage health care effectively until the health care providers focus on doing what's right for the patients instead of protecting themselves. And that requires a system of justice, not that protects them whenever they did something wrong. They should be accountable sooner. And our best estimate is that actually this will compensate more people. But it will not allow claims to go forward, for example, with babies born with cerebral palsy, because nothing the doctor or hospital could have done could have caused it. And it's the fact that the current system is more, and studies have shown this, the liability is more correlated with the extent of the tragedy rather than the actual error by the provider. So that's one idea that's fairly mature and we think will happen. It's not that dissimilar from systems they use in Sweden, New Zealand, and other countries. We're at the beginning of working with the American Law Institute on putting together a program, rethinking the role of judges versus juries in civil cases. The basic idea would be that judges have an obligation to represent the interests and the freedoms of all of society and to draw boundaries as a matter of law of who can sue for what. The legislature hasn't spoken, and if a claim will affect the conduct of people not in the courtroom, then the choice is either you let the claimant set public policy by default, or the judge makes a ruling as a matter of law. And so we're working with a number of senior judges. We did a forum 2 years ago that where Justice Kennedy and Lord Hoffman came over from the House of Lords, and a number of scholars came together to start this discussion. And this will be, if we succeed in it, will be a fairly dramatic shift in the judges' conception of their jobs. In schools, as Andrew said, we're interested in basically letting public schools operate with the same freedoms as charter schools and the same accountability. You know, spontaneity, humor, personality, all these things are vital to effective teaching and to an effective culture in a school. Bureaucracy is the enemy of all those things. There's really no good reason for most of the bureaucracy in schools. You can have basic principles that people can enforce without having thousands of rules or due process hearings. There are plenty of ways to guard against unfairness without the adversarial system. You can have a site-based, many schools have these, student government committees that oversee discipline, for example. There are lots of ways of doing it that make more sense. The hardest part of making these changes, I think, is giving judges and officials back the authority to actually assert value judgments of what's reasonable and what's not, and so what's right and what's wrong as a matter of law. Because the reason we sort of fell into this mess is because we woke up to abuses in the 1960s, racism, gender discrimination, pollution, among others, and they were real abuses, and we wanted to create a system where people couldn't have bad values anymore. And so we got this idea that you'd let any aggrieved person sue for whatever they wanted. They could defend their own rights. We had the idea that we should have more rules to tell officials to do the right thing so they could never do the wrong thing again. The problem is we created a system trying to avoid bad values in which people could no longer assert good values. It just doesn't work. It's not human. Law is a human system. It requires the constant application of social norms. You go back and read Holmes and Cardozo, that's what they're saying. Without the active application of social norms by the people with responsibility, especially judges and officials, then the legal system no longer is fair. America's legal system today is not fair, and it undermines our freedom. This doesn't mean that the people and judges and others can do whatever they want. They're still accountable. They're still bounded by legal goals and principles. The judges, trial judges, are accountable to appellate judges. Teachers are accountable to principals, who are accountable to school boards. The president's accountable to the voters. But they need to be accountable up the line based on the effect on all of society, not down the line to any angry person. We can't run a society by the lowest common denominator. And that's what we're trying to do in America. You know, we've been taught that authority is the enemy of freedom. That's not true. Authority is essential to freedom. If the judge doesn't have authority to toss out a claim as being excessive or unreasonable in accord with social norms, then all of us will go through the day looking over our shoulders. If the teacher doesn't have the authority to maintain order and respect in the classroom, then pretty soon none of the kids can learn. If the president doesn't have authority to spend the money to build the power lines out to the wind farms, then we're not going to start addressing global warming. We have to restore the authority structures of our society in order to get back our freedom. A free society requires red lights and green lights. And if you don't have them, if the legal system doesn't provide them, then what happens is we get gridlock and we're paralyzed. And that's what's happened in America. And that's why I think this is an important issue for lawyers, law students, and law schools to address, to try to fix the system so that we can get back to try to meet the challenges of this new century. Thank you.